You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Even to the most casual observer, Iraq would appear to be a mess. After a period of relative calm, bombs are exploding again, killing citizens and soldiers almost daily. In fact, today, a bombing outside an army recruitment center killed dozens and injured several times more. And this just weeks before the U.S. has committed to withdraw its combat troops. The parliamentary elections in March may have been the catalyst for the violence, and the fact that a government still hasn't been formed 5 months after seems to be prolonging the agony. But according to Joost Hilterman, a seasoned, longtime observer of Iraq and the region, none of this should come as a surprise. He's the Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group, and his article on the situation, Iraq, the Impasse, appeared in the summer issue of the New York Review of Books. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show. Hello.
Hi, Len. Thanks for getting me on your show.
The Iraqi parliamentary elections were held on March 7th, and the results were contested and close, but didn't somebody win?
Somebody won. But a couple of things about that. Iyad Alawi of the secular Iraqiya list won the elections with a narrow majority of 91 seats against the incumbent Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki with 89 seats. And so he thinks and feels strongly that he has the right to form the next government and to become the next prime minister. Now, Prime Minister Maliki has challenged the election results, says that he has been cheated out of them, but now has broadly accepted them while continuing to say that really there was some cheating going on. But he's also saying that as a Shiite prime minister, and the Shiites being the majority in Iraq, that if the Shiites can get their act together and form a single bloc, they would be the largest bloc in parliament and as such would have the right to form the government. And things are now stuck over this very conflict.
Well, Alawi is a Shiite as well, but didn't al-Maliki just recently accuse him of being the representative of Sunni interests?
That's right. Alawi is not the kind of Shiite that the Shiites like, meaning he is a secular Shiite who is not in any way aligned with Iran. From Alawi's side, the Maliki-type Shiites are essentially pro-Iranian Islamist Shiites. They may be the majority in politics today in Iraq, but they are not the original Iraqis who pride themselves on the secularism, and Alawi represents that. Now, he has got in his bloc a lot of Sunnis, but he also has a significant number of secular Shiites. So his bloc is verily cross-sectarian, I would say.
Well, is it likely that al-Maliki will be able to bring together enough Shiites of the sort that he feels would support him to put together government? And if he does, how come he hasn't been able to do it until now? What do we need to know about the Iraqi parliamentary system to understand why there is an impasse today?
The only thing that's blocking Shiite unity is Mr. Maliki himself, because his potential Shiite allies are willing to ally themselves with his bloc, but would not accept him as prime minister. It's all, in the end, about who will be prime minister of Iraq. And so at the moment, there is total deadlock. People are still talking, but the efforts of the two Shiite lists to come together and the separate efforts of Maliki's list to get together with Iyad Alawi's secular list have both foundered.
So if al-Maliki just withdrew, perhaps the impasse would be resolved?
If he just withdrew, but he has no reason to do that. He thinks that he can outlast everyone by just sticking around, that people will eventually just accede to the notion that by default he should be prime minister. But the question is really who will throw him under the bus? And that the mechanism for that is yet unclear. It might require some kind of intervention, either by the United States, which has worked behind the scenes but has not been publicly assertive on this question, or by neighboring Iran, which has significant influence in Iraq, or by the Shiite clerical leadership in Najaf, which has an interest in preserving Shiite unity, but also in having the political process move forward, because they are quite in tune with what the people are saying, and the people of Iraq are tremendously frustrated by all of these non-developments.
Of course, the problem didn't begin with the election. Before the election, there was a debate over whether the list should be closed or open, and on things like how to count the the people of Kirkuk. What's the background behind those questions, and what was the result?
Well, there was a long debate in the fall of 2009 about the new electoral law that was going to guide these elections. These matters were eventually resolved through a set of compromises. The clerical leadership in Najaf did insist, and they were not the only ones, but they were the most authoritative on this question, they did insist on an open list system where the people of Iraq would vote for individuals rather than for political blocks with a set leadership structure and hierarchy. And this was very good in a way because it gave further buy-in for local constituencies. And new people have entered the parliament that never would have shown up if the party lists had determined who would run on their slates. So the new parliament is going to be an entirely new animal, and this is a very interesting development. And we'll see how that's going to work out once it starts working, which it, of course, hasn't done yet. On the issue of Kirkuk, this is a very long-standing question that is related to a deep antagonism between Kurdish nationalism and Arab nationalism in Iraq. Kirkuk is a city that sits on a fault line between Kurdish Iraq and Arab Iraq, and also in an area that happens to be rich in oil. Everything in Kirkuk is about demographics. Who is there? Who used to be there? Who was pushed out? Who has come back? Who's manipulating what demographic statistics? And the problem in Kirkuk has been, therefore, to hold elections and to govern it, and eventually to decide, where it should belong. Should Kirkuk be part of the Kurdistan region, which is an autonomous region, or should it remain directly under Baghdad? For the electoral law, this issue was resolved by a compromise which basically said that once the elections have been held in Kirkuk, which of course now they have been, as they were in the rest of Iraq, the voter rolls can be challenged, and that process could still happen.
You wrote several articles before the elections anticipating a stalemate to forming a government. What were some of the things you wrote that have come to pass, and have there been any surprises?
It was easy to predict a stalemate only on the issue of Kirkuk, because what has happened in the past elections in January 2005 and in December 2005 is that there were serious differences in when the governments were being formed at the time over the issue of Kirkuk. The Kurds would raise it and say, listen, we have inserted this in, or we have all agreed to this interim constitution and then to this permanent constitution, and there are articles in it about Kirkuk, and we care about this issue very much, and we want the government that we are going to be part of to implement those articles, obviously to the benefit of the Kurds. This was their perspective. And the government had to agree to these conditions up to a point, and then in the end ended up not implementing any of them. That was their way out of this. But Kirkuk was a divisive issue that has held up the formation of the previous governments. It took 4 months in 2005, and it took 6 months in 2006. We're now 5 months into the process, and I would predict that we won't have a government for another few months. So this is going to be the longest one of the three.
Kirkuk, well, this is kind of like the New York State legislature.
Something trying to come like up. That. You could also look at my country, the Netherlands, where we have to form coalition governments, and it takes a long time. But the difference is that the Netherlands and other constitutional democracies have institutions. Iraq is very weak. There is lots of violence, and we saw another example of it today, and things could fall apart. And what I think what surprised me was the closeness of the results, that in fact there were two lists that were only two seats apart. And this is what has really caused the predicament that we're in today, where we cannot settle, or the Iraqis cannot settle on a prime minister.
My guest is Joost Hilterman, the Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group. He wrote an article called Iraq, the Impasse, for the summer issue of the New York Review of Books. You say that Iraqi leaders are ruled by fear. What are their fears?
Well, there are all kinds of fears. Iraq is a post-conflict society, and with conflict still very much on the mind. It was very recent, of course, that was the Saddam period, which was very violent. There was the U.S. invasion of 2003. Then there was a sectarian war that fought itself out in the streets of Baghdad and other mixed population areas in 2005 to 2008. And the primary fears are on the part of the Shiite-led government that the former regime will still come back, that the Ba'ath Party, that Saddam Hussein's people are still there, are tunneling into the new order as a fifth column and will rise their ugly heads and try to gain control again. This is a very deep-seated fear.
Through Syrian intervention?
Not Syrian intervention so much, but maybe by the Arab states more broadly, because the Ba'ath Party is split, in fact, now, and is part of it is in Syria, and another part is in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. But in any case, that this mindset, the people who have this mindset, are distributed over the Arab world, and with the help of Arab states, will come back in. The opposite fear is precisely from among those people and the broader secular Iraqi community, that the Shiite-led government in Baghdad is a proxy for Iran, and that over time the Iranians will get will just get a bigger foothold in Iraq and take over the place.
And there are any number of popular conspiracy theories around Baghdad and Iraq these days. Where are they coming from?
Well, you know, with every bombing, you know, these fears are exacerbated. With every, deadlock in the political process, external actors step in and start manipulating. You know, there are meetings, there are phone calls, there are visits from, Iranians and Turks and Syrians and others. There's money is being channeled into, particular coffers, belonging to certain political parties in Iraq. And everybody either sees that or thinks he sees that. And this aggravates the fears that exist.
Well, we'll take a little break. When we'll come back, we'll look at some of the real serious players like Iran and Turkey. We haven't even mentioned Turkey. And just what's happening with oil and gas reserves and other related matters as we continue this conversation with Joost Hilterman, whose article, Iraq, The Impasse, is in the summer issue of the New York Review of Books. We're back with Joost Hilterman, who is the Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group. He's written extensively on the Middle East, especially Iraq and its neighbors. And he's written an article for the summer issue of the New York Review of Books called Iraq, The Impasse, talking about what is now a five-month political impasse, which has led to pretty much no government in Iraq for 5 months. And looks like this is going to continue for a while longer. You spoke with Hassan Kazemi Komi, the ambassador from Iran to Iraq. What outcome does he say his country wants in Iraq?
Well, that's the funny thing. What he says sounds very familiar, very similar to what the United States wants, which is to have a government in Iraq that functions with a blossoming economy that has good trade relations with Iran and with all its neighbors. He presented a very peaceful vision for Iraq. He wasn't really going into sort of some of the more nefarious things that Iran has been involved in Iraq over the past few years.
Well, for example, damming of rivers that flow from Iran to Iraq, and Iran's claim on an oil well near its border. Can you explain those two incidents and what they reveal about the Iraq-Iran relationship?
Well, that's right. I mean, the Iranians would like to present themselves as sort of the friends of Iraq, because they clearly were the enemies of Iraq while Saddam Hussein was in power. And, of course, there was a very prolonged and brutal war in the 1980s between Iran and Iraq.
Do those tensions still linger in the aftermath of that war?
Very much so. The tensions are there, but also more the notion that there still ought to be reparations, and also the notion that we need to make sure this doesn't happen again. And of course, there are different ways of trying to prevent that, both constructive and maybe less constructive. So the trauma is still very much there. Also, if you realize that in Iranian hospitals there are still Iranian former soldiers who are dying from the after effects of chemical warfare, mustard gas in particular, even today. So this is still very much alive. In Iraq, this also is still alive. So the Iranians now, Saddam out of the way, see themselves as the friends of Iraq. And, of course, they have a government in power that is Shiite Islamist in ideology and as close to Iran as one probably could get in Iraq. But the bottom line is the Iraqis don't really like Iran, and they don't certainly trust Iran. And these issues come out when certain events occur. One was late last year when there was a little conflict over flag raising on an oil field that straddles the Iranian-Iraqi border, and the Iraqis accused the Iranian soldiers of going across that border and raising the Iranian flag on Iraqi territory, with the Iranians saying that, in fact, this was still within Iranian territory. The problem is that the border is not very clearly demarcated in this area. And, in fact, there is now a commission that is looking at that border. So there are, solutions to these problems. And so it's not all, woe. But it's indicative of the feelings that the Iraqis have, the nationalist feelings that they have vis-a-vis the Iranians when this happens. The water is another big issue, because Iraq is a downstream country for river systems that originate in Turkey and Iran. And both Turkey and Iran have unilaterally constructed dams at the headwaters of these rivers. And this severely restricts the flow of these rivers into Iraq and then into the Gulf. And this affects the agriculture, of course. And also Iraq has been in a drought, really, for the last few years. And the marshes in southern Iraq, which is really in the area of the confluence of the main river systems, the Tigris and the Euphrates, which come from Turkey, but also some of the Iranian rivers, are drying up. And this is essentially destroying an entire ecosystem. So the Iraqis feel very strongly about this, and have complained time and again with the Iranians, but are getting really no response.
Well, since Turkey is another Iraqi neighbor that's also trying to gain influence, isn't this hurting their attempts?
Is it hurting whose attempts?
Turkey's. If they're damming rivers, and it's having an effect on Iraq, Turkey, which is secular and Sunni, has a lot of a mix of worries about the Kurds, but also a desire to gain access to Iraqi oil and gas. I wonder just how much influence they can have, since much of the oil is in the Kurdish territory, which would put Turkey at something of a disadvantage.
Well, that's right. Turkey also has to play a careful game, because it wants certain things from the Iraqis, and it wants to preserve Iraq's territorial unity, because it doesn't want to end up with an independent Kurdistan on its southern border that would, serve as a model for the Kurds in Turkey. So it has to play a careful game. What Turkey's most worried about, actually, is the growing Iranian influence in Iraq, because, as you said, Turkey is a secular state. It has a somewhat Islamist government, but a very moderate one, and certainly a Sunni one, not a Shiite one. So it's concerned about what Iran is doing in Iraq, and it is trying to work with the government in Baghdad to curb Iranian influence. But the problem Turkey faces is that it doesn't really trust the government in Baghdad, because it might be an Iranian proxy, or it might not be. And so it is negotiating. It has signed some agreements with the Baghdad government, but it's also hedging its bets, and it's working with the Kurds in northern Iraq in order to have a plan B, essentially, that if Iraq falls apart or falls under the sway of Iran, that Turkey would still have a buffer on its border that is somewhat stable and reliable and under its control, and that's the Kurds. And the Kurds happen to have significant, or at least that's what people think, it's not really been confirmed yet, but significant amounts of oil and gas. And Turkey, which doesn't have oil and gas, desperately wants that. So right now, a very delicate dance is being played out over these issues, over energy security, over the integrity of Iraq's borders, over the influence of the various neighboring states after U.S. forces withdraw. And nobody really knows what will happen, and everybody is hedging their bets.
Well, a lot of the refugees have gone into Syria, which, like Iraq, was a Ba'athist country, but as you point out, the Ba'ath Party split. Still, does Syria have much of an opportunity to gain any influence here?
Syria would love to gain more influence, but has a particularly poor relationship with the Maliki government. This is one of these ironies of the region. Syria and Iran have a close relationship over Lebanon, for example, and have had it for years, even had it during the Iran-Iraq war. But that relationship might change once American forces withdraw from Iraq, because Iran and Syria both wanted those forces out. But they don't agree on the nature of Iraq and what it should look like, because the Iranians clearly want a government in power that is pro-Iran, and so they would want the Shiites to run Iraq. But Syria doesn't want that at all. They are an Arab regime, and they prefer Iyad Alawi and a secular group to run Iraq. So at the moment, the Syrians don't have a lot of influence, but they're trying to get in, and they're supporting Alawi, along with the other Arab states, and in fact Turkey, against Iran. And so this is another really delicate issue that is being negotiated in back rooms between these countries.
Now, we've seen a lot of street violence since the election. Would it abate if a government were formed?
Well, there's no doubt that there are there are spoilers out there who want to exploit the current fragility of the political process in order to catalyze something bigger and to basically explode the whole thing. Whether they will succeed is a big question, and I suppose that as long as there is not a total breakdown in politics, they will not succeed. And so you will get these attacks that we saw today against police recruitment centers, and as we have seen in the past months as well, but that may not catalyze anything bigger. But for sure, the longer the stalemate is going to last, or if we end up with a government that is narrowly based and excludes not only political party but an entire community, for example, the Sunnis, then you could well see greater violence emerging on the basis of these attacks which are clearly designed to produce that.
So is most of the violence being perpetrated by the Sunnis?
Well, that's hard to say. We often don't know who the perpetrators are.
Well, wouldn't you know by the targets?
Well, the targets have shifted, but today we know the targets are especially the security forces of Iraq, and that could be any sort of actor that feels excluded from government, and that wouldn't only be Sunnis necessarily. But many of these attacks seem to be attributed by Iraqis to al-Qaeda in Iraq, and often also claimed by them. So I think they still do play a role, maybe not as significant as they used to. And there are other insurgent groups that have not joined the political process that still have a margin of maneuverability in the country. But it's not like two or three years ago. So at the moment, they're all on the defensive, but they're waiting. They're just waiting for an opening to get back in.
My guest is Joost Hilteman. He's written an article called Iraq, the Impasse, for the summer issue of the New York Review of Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What's happening because a government hasn't been formed? Can anything be done? Can bills be passed? Can foreign policy be implemented? What's happening with oil revenues?
Well, the oil revenues are still coming in because oil is still being pumped. And they are being shared because there's a de facto sharing mechanism in place. But there is no new oil law, and in fact, there is no new legislation at all because the parliament hasn't met except to inaugurate itself back in June. Because it cannot agree on the process of forming a government and on the major appointments, prime minister and president and speaker of parliament, they've simply not met. And so they certainly haven't met to legislate, which is what they ought to be doing. And so essentially there is very little governance going on. At the local level, local government can still deliver services. The ministries can still deliver services. But all major decisions are being deferred.
What role has the judiciary played since the election?
Well, the judiciary, the Iraq's Federal Supreme Court, had the role of certifying the election results. So after the Electoral Commission had essentially reviewed the results and had done the counting and then there was a recount, the Supreme Court certified the results. And it played that role, and it's otherwise has stayed out of the process. So it right now it's on the sidelines.
Well, how much are the U.S. and its allies contributing to running the country in the absence of a political government?
Well, the United States, is drawing down its troop presence in the country. It's had over 100,000 troops, and now is going down to 50,000 by the end of this month. So to the extent that the Pentagon had programs in place on the ground and was doling out funding to various projects in towns and villages, all of this is now being sharply curtailed as these troops withdraw. Not only is essential manpower disappearing, but also the funding is going to change because in the new American budget, the funding is shifting essentially from Pentagon to the State Department. For example, the entire enterprise of standing up a viable police force in Iraq through training is being handed over to the State Department, which in an unprecedented way has to now deal with this issue. So there is also an important transfer of responsibilities taking place, but overall there is a reduction. And this happens right at the time when we have political stalemate and lack of governance at the top in Iraq. So it's not a very healthy coincidence.
Doesn't everyone say that they would like a broad-based coalition to run Iraq? We have a situation here where we have a country that isn't exactly evenly split, but has some balance between Arab Sunnis and Persian Shiites, two groups that have been have found it impossible to agree over the centuries. In fact, I got some emails once when we talked about the difference between Sunnis and Shiites from some Sunnis who said, the Shiites are not really Muslims, they are heretics. But if Iraq could work this out, wouldn't that be seen as a kind of a model for the rest of the Muslim world?
Yeah, if it works out.
Is that at all possible?
Nothing is impossible, and it requires will. And I think what the main obstacle Iraq faces is the fear that divides people. And it needs to build institutions in order to allay those fears. If you have strong institutions, then you can build and proper checks and balances embedded in the system. Then you can start allaying those fears. I just want to just correct one thing, because the Shiites of Iraq don't consider themselves as Persians at all. That is a Sunni perception on the part of some Sunnis, mm-hmm. not all. But the Shiites in Iraq are very much Arab, of course. There is only Arabs in Iraq, no Persians. And they pride themselves on that as well. There is a strong sense of Arab nationalism that is, true for Sunnis and Shiites alike.
And is that why the Ba'ath Party actually was also had Christians? They all saw themselves as Arab nationalists.
Well, that's right. The Ba'ath Party, of course, was founded by a Christian from Syria, and its original membership was predominantly Shiite. It was eventually taken over by a Sunni gang from Tikrit, who was Sunni only in name. They were just secular, and that was Saddam Hussein's clan. But it was mostly a Shiite party at its outset, as were all parties in Iraq, because it was the opposition against a Sunni Hashemite king. So the Communist Party was also heavily Shiite. And then, of course, the Dawa party that the Prime Minister Maliki now heads was the Shiite Islamist party at the time. But you're right to mention the need or the sort of the consensus both in Iraq and outside of Iraq for a broadly inclusive government. And I think there's a choice here, and it's a difficult one. A choice between having a majoritarian government where the strongest party forms the government and everybody else goes into opposition. This is something you would have in a normal, well-constituted democracy. Or you would have a power-sharing agreement, a broadly inclusive government. The downside the positive thing of a broadly inclusive government is that everybody's at the table, nobody feels excluded, and so you're not giving anyone an incentive to resort to violence in this sort of very fragile stage in Iraq's development. But the downside is that it's very hard to come to any kind of decisions on any major issue as a government when everybody's at the table and you need to reach consensus. And so these kinds of governments don't govern very well. And that in the long term can also be destabilizing. So the question is, what do you want to have for the short and medium term? A majoritarian government that has parties excluded that could resort to violence, or a broadly inclusive government that will not give rise to violence, but might govern so poorly that eventually voters will feel disenfranchised and will resort to insurgency. This is the dilemma Iraq faces today.
It's been reported that President Obama wrote a letter to the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, the highest religious authority in Shia Islam, who rarely intervenes in Iraqi politics, and the president urged him to help settle the dispute between the parties. What are the chances that that's true, and if so, is it likely to yield much success?
Well, I cannot confirm that there is such a letter. I've asked the administration about it, and they stay mum on it. So you can take that one way or the other. But I think if President Obama wrote such a letter, that would have been a pretty smart thing to do, because in the end, the solution would have to come from inside Iraq, even if it is with some outside help. That outside help should remain fairly invisible. But it has to come from inside Iraq. Now, Ayatollah Sistani is the senior most Shiite leader in Iraq and, in fact, in the Shiite world. He is Iranian. He's a Persian. But he moved to Iraq in his 20s and has lived there ever since. And he has proven to be, in many ways, to be more of an Iraqi nationalist than many of Iraq's political leaders who have only got their own partisan and personal interests in mind and not really the nation's. The solution may have to come from a man like Sistani and his peers in the clerical leadership. But the question is, they don't really want to interfere in politics. They have a history of not interfering in politics. They're opposed to it, in fact. At the same time, they have the interests of the nation at heart, and they have put subtle pressure so far on the political leaders to settle the differences and to form a government as soon as possible.
Some say that Iran is waiting for the United States to get out before a government is formed so that Washington can claim success in Iraq.
I've made that point in my article because that was the clear impression I received when I was in Baghdad in June from some of the politicians. They felt that, you know, Iran was not going to do anything to bring about a government in Iraq until after the U.S. drawdown was completed on August 31st, because they don't want the Americans to be able to claim that, you know, they left Iraq and were able to form a government before they left and claim victory that way. But we'll have to see what Iran will do after August 31st, because after all, the Americans haven't left. There are still 50,000 troops there until the end of 2011. And so I think the Iranians will continue to play a spoiler role until all the last U.S. soldier has left Iraqi territory. And from then on, the curious thing is then Iran may have to play a different role in Iraq and a bit more of a constructive role in order to get the kind of Iraq that it could live with. And that would require some nation building, some institution building.
Yos Hilterman is the Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group. His article on the situation in Iraq, 5 months after the election. It's called Iraq, the Impasse. It's in the summer issue of the New York Review of Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.